Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, let's talk Eastern Conference Finals. A couple of days back, the Toronto Raptors were done. They were dead. They were down 2-0. They had been blown out by 22 in Game 2. And they were just going back to Toronto to die. And then start the eventual rebuild when Kawhi Leonard left them in a few weeks. We all knew that. We had gone from an epic second round to teetering on the verge of sweeps in both conference finals. Milwaukee was going to wrap up their series, and then they'd have more than a week to rest up for Golden State, who's already done. But then Kawhi turned in an epic 52-minute performance on a bad leg. That was in that Game 3 double overtime win. Suddenly, that series actually had a pulse. Or did it? I mean, let's be real. What that was a win that could have and should have been a loss against a Bucks team that really didn't play that well. And there was no way that Kawhi was going to bounce back on that bum wheel after playing 52 minutes against a Bucks team that was going to wake the hell up for Game 4. So great. Toronto lives to fight another day, but there's no way that they win another day. At least that's the way I saw it. And so did most anybody else who knows anything about the game. Actually, the exact opposite went down. Instead, the Raptors dominated 120-102, an 18-point blowout. And now we have ourselves a series. This matchup has been hit with the paddles.
Rebound, Moreland. Raptors will take it over center and dribble out the clock. Toronto will even the series. They win it 120-102. We'll see you in Milwaukee on Thursday night.
Raptors radio. I love the end of the game when Toronto dribbled out the clock.
Rebound, Moreland. Raptors will take it over center and dribble out the clock. Toronto will even the series.
I get it. No offense, bro. That happens to me too. There are times when I roll in here and I forgot to set the alarm clock.
The clock.
Anyway, happens to us all.
The clock.
Toronto had to have that last night. Toronto had to dribble out the clock.
The clock.
Had to have it last night. And I don't mean Toronto the team. When I say Toronto had to have it last night, I don't mean Toronto the team. I mean Toronto the clock.
The clock.
No, I mean Toronto the city. The city wanted that badly. Did you see the crowd in Jurassic Clock?
Dribble out the clock.
Jurassic Park, I mean, last night. How many clocks?
The clock.
How many blocks did that stretch for? It looked like a victory parade, and it was actually just people looking to watch the game on that big clock.
The clock.
Anyway, there were celebrities, right? There were celebrities in the house. Timbaland was in the house. Donovan Bailey was in the house. And, of course, Drake. Drake. Always Drake. Of course, Drake was doing what he always does, which is a lot. And by a lot, I mean way too much. Like losing his ish when the freak missed a free throw. You've seen it. Totally out of control. Or at least I thought so. I thought he was totally out of control, but there was more. Because then I saw him giving Raptors head coach Nick Nurse a deep tissue massage during the fourth quarter. The hell is that? I mean, seriously, I know this guy is into the game. I know this guy wants to win badly. But when was the last time you saw a fan give a head coach a quick rub down during the fourth quarter of a playoff game? When? Like, I don't remember Jack Nicholson breaking out the baby oil on Pat Riley back in the day. Nor do I recall Usher giving David Blatt a chiropractic adjustment. Or Billy Crystal getting Vinny Del Negro to loosen up. I mean, dude, that's just weird. I half expected Drake to drag his massage table out to center court during timeouts so he could rub Nurse up properly. But the amazing thing is, it worked because they got the win. And last night's win came with Kawhi clearly banged up. And banged up probably doesn't even do it justice. He was out there on one leg. He only had 19 points on the night. That's the guy that Drake should have gone all shiatsu on. Or Pascal Siakam. He still wasn't right after he played 51 minutes in game three. Drake should have broken out the hot stones and the Enya CD on Siakam. What? Aromatherapy didn't want any of that? Is this guy a platinum recording artist? Or some dude in a mall kiosk? I thought he was going to have Nurse sit backwards and then smash him into that face contraption. You know, that weird part massage table, part Hannibal Lecter mask that losers smash you into at airports? Yo, coach. Yo, coach. Just stick your feet into this tub of hot water that 50 other losers have already stood in today. Dude, Brookstone wouldn't tolerate some of that crap that Drake tried to pull last night. And did Drake give Nurse one of those bent, crooked pens for free when he was done? I mean, damn. Bob Kraft and his attorneys are killing themselves to prevent the release of that videotape of his 78-year-old junk. But the entire world can be subjected to Drake rubbing up Nick Nurse on live TV? The hell is that all right? I mean, seriously, step back from that for a minute. Think about that for 1 minute. In the fourth quarter of a conference championship game, a must-win game from the Raptors, and the dude from Hotline Bling is giving the coach a deep tissue massage that he obviously didn't want and didn't ask for, and it's happening in front of about a billion people. I mean, seriously, it's not like Nurse said, hey, listen, I'm freaking out here. Get Drake. I need my rub right now, damn it. Nah, Nick's probably like working up his next defensive set or substitution pattern when all of a sudden he's thinking, damn, some drunk groupie's getting nice and rubbing on me. Man, she's pretty strong. Holy crap, it's dude who recorded Hold On, We're Going Home who's hitting me with this unwanted rub down. I mean, weird. Normally weird is good, but not in this case. I mean, seriously, the hell is that? Just know this, you will never, ever, ever see a member of the XR4TI rubbing me up during the show, no matter how stressful it gets. I mean that, Eisenhower, I'm looking at you. You too, Hawk. Anyway, I got distracted. Back to the game for a minute. Milwaukee respects Kawhi so much. And I mean that, Eisenhower. Don't you come in here for any other reason but to drop an email. You know, maybe they respect Kawhi too much. To the point that even though he's not right, they're still locked in on him defensively. They were so focused on that one-legged superstar that they let the other guys get loose. And the other guys did get loose. Norman Powell, 18 points. Marc Gasol, 17 points, 7 assists. Serge Ibaka, 17 points, 13 boards. Fred VanVleet, 13 points, 6 assists. FVV went from hitting absolutely nothing to hitting everything last night. Then you've got Kyle Lowry, my favorite. There may not be a more polarizing player on the Raptors roster, maybe not even in the whole Eastern Conference, than Kyle Lowry. Fair or not. This guy's come to embody everything that has been good and bad about the Raptors over the past few years. And last night, it was all good. Kawhi's busted up. Lowry does everything. 6 of 11 from deep. 3 of 7. Or actually, 6 of 11 from the field. 3 of 7 from deep. And the guy was making every hustle play, getting extra possessions, making winning plays, keeping possessions alive. Kawhi won't get into details, but make no mistake about it, he's busted up. Ask Danny Green. Quote, he's playing through pain. He can't even celebrate baskets because of how painful it is. You dunk on a guy like Giannis, you're worried about your knee. It shows that he's fighting. We're going to need him to fight through the rest of the series. We need more. That says something. That says a lot. He's taken them from completely out of this series to right back in it and maybe even in the driver's seat. This is all about a guy that almost all of you have questioned. So if I'm Toronto, I'm going to make sure Drake is on that plane to Milwaukee and he's got his massage table, oils, Enya's greatest hits, and magic hands with him. I got a sports analogy for you. Any coach or GM will tell you, the foundation of any great team is great talent. So it's no surprise that teams dedicate so much time and effort towards finding the right players. The same rule applies when it comes to hiring. You need top talent, but you don't have endless resources to find it. What you do have is ZipRecruiter. They scout talent for you. With ZipRecruiter, one click sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. But they don't stop there. Their powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and then actively invites them to apply to your job. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through that site within the very first day. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/clone. ZipRecruiter.com/CLONES. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. We are joined by Ice Cube. Cube, what's going on? How are you?
What's up, Jim? How you doing, man?
Good, good. But how about you?
All good, man. It's always good to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. Good to have you back. So the third Big Three season kicks off in exactly 1 month, Cube, on CBS. You and I talked about this when you first started that league, and it was clear you had a big vision for it. But what's it like to enter year three and to be on CBS in prime time?
Man, it's great. You know, this is what I envisioned when I was sleeping at night and dreaming what the league could be. And to see that, you know, the players have bought in, the fans have bought in, the sports media has bought in, and now we're on a big major network like CBS. You know, the sky's the limit for the Big Three. You know, all we got to do is show up and play good basketball, and everything should be all right.
Cube joining us. All right, so I had Jason Terry on the program recently, and he was talking about how much he's looking forward to getting back on the court this year. Part of the vision that you and I talked about back in the day was you wanted to create something where the best could keep on playing. So what's it mean to add guys like Terry, Gilbert Arenas, Greg Oden, Lamar Odom, and Kendrick Perkins?
I mean, it's a big deal. You know, guys who got, you know, big names have made their mark in basketball. They don't really have nothing to prove, so it's all about the competition. You know, it's all about them still fulfilling those juices they did when they were young, which is about, you know, playing, being the best, playing against the best, showing that you still got the skills. In the half-court setting, these guys are gonna remind you of the times when they were in their prime on the NBA floor. So, you know, it's great for the league. You know, we knew we had to get younger. We wanted to get younger, wanted to get more athletic. We wanted to get players that were fresh off of NBA courts. And we're doing that. You know, Mario Chalmers, Carlos Arora. These are names that, are big-time names that just stepped off the basketball court. So it's great to have them in the Big Three, still showing the fans what they do best.
Cube joining us, talking about Big Three. Let me give you a couple of other names. It's been a pioneering league in a number of different ways, and a big part of that is the diversity of coaches in the league. Nancy Lieberman led the Power to the title last year, and now Lisa Leslie is going to join the league as a coach. How important is it to be a pioneer in your approach?
Well, you know, I've been doing that my whole career, and I definitely believe in giving people a shot that, you know, normally society says, you know, this is not for you, or, you know, maybe you should wait a little longer before you take this step. You know, I'm all about breaking down barriers, knocking down doors, breaking glass ceilings, and also just putting the best people in place, you know. And sometimes the best person is not a man. So, you know, it's just smart business to me, you know. You want to find the best people to grow this league. Lisa Leslie, Nancy Lieberman, by winning the championship, showed that this is not a stunt. This is for real. And Amy Trash, who's our chairman of the board. You know, we're doing what we need to do to put the best people in place, no matter what gender they are.
Big Three starts on June 22nd, live from Detroit. It's going to be on CBS. Ice Cube joins me for a few more moments. Now, Cube, last week, I'm changing up on you, but last week was the 29th anniversary of the release of America's Most Wanted, and Chuck D tweeted last week about how proud he was to be involved, and he added, quote, "The start of AMW starts with me sitting in Ice Cube's car outside of CVS in Glendale. He inquires about the first move. He picks up 3 89-cent notebooks and simply just talked about his recording goals, pen, 3 notebooks, 0 electronics. The man has 3 brains running, I swear." What do you remember about that experience with Chuck? What was that like?
Just that Chuck is so generous. You know, here he was at the top. You know, P.E., Public Enemy, was, you know, arguably the top hip-hop group at the time. And he had time for a local rapper from L.A., you know, and to give me a lot of good advice and to, you know, show me what it takes to be an artist out on my own, you know. Chuck D is my favorite rapper of all times, you know, not just because of, you know, his subject matter, but the kind of man he is. No ego, just willing to help a young MC reach his full potential. So, you know, that's a man that I'm going to forever be grateful to him. People like Dr. Dre, people like my man John Singleton will forever be in my hearts and in my minds, and I will always mention them when it comes to my career.
Cube joining us. I also love Chuck. I got to get Chuck back on this show. Cube, you mentioned John Singleton. He's the legendary director who passed away recently. What kind of an impact did he have on your career and your life?
Everything. You know, I was just talking to my wife, you know, when he passed, that, you know, we wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here right here talking to you, Jim, without John Singleton, because I just wanted to be the best rapper in the world. And nobody really know how far that would have took me without getting into Hollywood, movies, TV. He taught me how to write. He taught me what it took to direct. You know, John Singleton was everything to me. Without John, you wouldn't have Friday. You wouldn't have Barbershop. You wouldn't have, you know, Ride Along. You know, it's just like you wouldn't have some of these movies. You wouldn't have had the Straight Outta Compton movie. We wouldn't have discovered Chris Tucker and Mike Epps. And, you know, he's put Angela Bassett on. He's put Cuba Gooding Jr., me, Nia Long, Regina King. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. John Singleton's impact on our lives is going to reverberate forever.
Cube, one last thought, one follow on that. I mean, you wanted to be the best rapper in the world, but what did you know about acting at that point? Because he pursued you for 2 years to be in Boys in the Hood. What did you know about acting, and what did his belief in you mean?
All I knew is that you go to the box office, you buy your ticket, and you go watch a good movie. That's all I knew about acting, you know. When he pursued me, I felt like I was totally unqualified. But he saw something in me that I didn't even see in myself. So that just shows you, you know, what kind of master we had among us by the name of John Singleton. You know, a guy who could see our potential even when we didn't see it. So, I mean, and that's not just my story, but, I mean, he went and got Busta Rhymes and put him in the movie. Tyrese Gibson put him in the movie. We were all in entertainment. We were Tupac Shakur. We were all just doing records, and he made us movie stars, and we're forever grateful.
He's an award-winning actor, director, producer, music icon, member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Remember, the third season of The Big Three starts on June 22nd. It's live from Detroit, 8 p.m. Eastern on CBS. Tickets for select cities are on sale right now at big3.com/tickets. Cube, it's great to have you back. Appreciate you, man. Thanks so much.
It's always good. I always love talking to you, Jim, man. Take it easy.
Don't take a chance on being stranded. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and get your battery tested. It is free of charge and one of the many services available. If your battery needs to be replaced, the professional parts people will help you find the exact battery for your car or truck. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. Steph Curry has been a man on a mission. And that mission included breaking the record for most points scored in a 4-game sweep. More than Shaq, more than Kobe, more than LeBron, more than Kareem, more than anybody. It included 26 made threes, which is the most in the first 4 games of a series. And that was after he put on that absolutely ridiculous 33-point performance in the second half of Game 6 in Houston. So I could argue it's the best 4.5-game stretch of Steph's career. And it's coming in the postseason with a busted finger and without two and sometimes three of their starters. A two-time league MVP we're talking about, and we're talking about him playing better right now than he ever has. One of the best to ever do it, playing better than he ever has. That's how good he's been. And yet, as good as Steph Curry's been, I might make the argument that he's not even the best player in the Western Conference Finals. He might not even be the best player on his own team right now because Draymond Green has been that good. Draymond Green nearly averaged a triple-double against Portland. Think about that for a minute. Nearly averaging a triple-double in the Conference Finals. He's playing insane lockdown defense. He's getting after it on the glass. He's pushing the pace even after Portland makes. And he's somehow turning an opponent's made basket into a fast break of his own. I mean, have you ever seen a guy do that, much less do that consistently? And on top of all of that, he did things like this to ice game four and that series.
Curry trying to relocate, gets free. Doubled immediately on the catch. Over to Draymond for three. It's up and good! Draymond Green! 119-150.
Now, it's not that long ago that this Draymond, this version of Draymond, seemed like he was never going to come back. Like, that guy was not what he used to be and might not make it back. It seemed like Draymond was a little bit out of shape. And it seemed like that shape was never coming back. I mean, sure, he was still playing good defense, but his offense was fading, and the Warriors become a lot easier to defend when you don't have to worry about him or guard him outside the three-point line. But then it all changed. It all changed when he leaned out. And this is an important thing for all of you dopes to hear. The reason I bring this up, because you kill any celebrity or athlete the moment he or she puts on even 1 ounce. You'll come flying over the walls like zombies in World War Z with your oh-so-hilarious food puns like pie-hard star Bruce Willis or Heavy-on Bell or Le'Veon Belt. Ricky Hatton has been retired for like 5 years, and yet you fools still call him Ricky Fatten. Kelvin Benjamin puts on a pound or two, and you've glossed him Calorie Benjamin or Kelvin Entimans or Kelvin Benjamin and Jerry's. Yet I never hear from any of you when somebody leans out. I never hear from any of you when somebody slims down. But I do get all sorts of tweets about Derek Eater. But when it turns out that there was something funky about that photo, I don't hear any apologies or any takebacks from any of you creeps. Just like I'm sure that if I looked right now, I'd find plenty of emails from a couple of months back about Philemond Green. Yet for some reason, not a single tweet or email from anybody about Draymond Lean. And I should, because according to reports, Draymond lost 25 pounds since March. And here's something else you need to hear. Listen and learn for two reasons. One, to give this guy credit, and so you can take notes. Because I'm pretty much sure, or I'm guessing, that all of you are not the 5% body legend or 5% body fat legends that y'all seem to be. According to Rachel Nichols, Green gave up Snickers, Cheetos, wine, and tequila. That's how he leaned out, by giving up Snickers, Cheetos, wine, and tequila. Tequila. I'm not sure what's more amazing, that Draymond was able to lose 25 pounds in that short a period of time, or that a world-class athlete playing at that high level was doing it while smashing Snickers, Cheetos, wine, and tequila. Reminds me of the time that I went in to say goodnight to my son Jake when Jake was 5, only to discover he had this crazy stash of Halloween candy under his bed. Some of it wrapped, some of it half-eaten, but he had a whole stash under his bed. I wonder if Draymond was stashing all his Snickers, Cheetos, and Don Julio under his bed. Or just rolling like Dwight Howard with that candy backpack and stashes all over the place. Got an even better question. How the hell did Draymond give it all up? Like, sugar is the new heroin. And this dude just went cold turkey? And not even one of those, hey, if you had to give up one, what would it be? If you had to choose, would you give up dessert or booze? Sugar or sauce? He did both. And if sugar isn't crack, then breakfast cereal is. And he quit all of it. Sugar, cereal, and the sauce. But again, I'm not sure what impresses me more. That he quit all of that, or that he was running with all of that on board in the first place. I just know that he wasn't playing at that typical Draymond level during the season, when he might have been carrying a few extra pounds. But how was he able to give all of that up? How was he able to play at any level eating all that? Either one of those things. Dwight Howard allegedly eating the equivalent of 24 Hershey bars a day and lugging around a backpack full of candy everywhere he went. Cannot believe that Draymond was on that diet. But then he cuts all of it out, just stops, cuts all that junk out from his diet, and he's back to being a Hall of Famer, an unstoppable force. It's amazing. You know what they say, right? Nothing tastes as good as thin feels. But if you ever want to know how good winning an NBA title feels, it's got to feel awesome if you're willing to give up all that, if it's worth it. So, point of this take is, get up in here and celebrate Draymond Lean or Draymond Greens. Because if you're going to kill other fat celebs, then you better come in here when they get right.
You give them some credit. I mean, for real.
Ben Mesrick is my guest. Ben, it is so good to see you. How are you?
I am psyched, Jim. And I came out to L.A. and I came down here because you launched my career, bringing down the house. It was almost two decades ago. And it was the clones buying that up and hitting Amazon and rising me up there that led to everything. So I am thrilled to start here. It's awesome.
Ben, it means so much to me that you always say that, and that's never been true. I don't know why you keep saying that. But I want to say, for me to you, though, when you consider the success that you've had and the amazing heater that you're on right now, that you always come back and you pay that respect to the clones, it means so much to me. And you chose the jungle for your first interview. Your first interview after Bitcoin Billionaires comes out. How is life for you on the very first day after the book comes out? What's that first day like?
You know, it's exciting and you're nervous about it because you have no idea how a book is going to, you know, how people are going to respond to a book. You know, when I sat down to write this book, I knew that there's a lot of controversial stuff in it. You have no idea how it's going to be accepted. So it's thrilling. The first day of a book tour, you don't know if it's going to be an explosion or it's going to be back to the drawing board. But I think this is a big story, and I was excited to do it. So I'm just excited.
I think this one's going to be really, really big. Ben Mesrick joining us. So when you get into the background of the book for a moment, this is a book that features two people that you have written about before, Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss, who were part of the Accidental Billionaires. Now, first, when you first met these guys and they first walked into a room, what did you think?
Yeah, so the Winklevi twins, when they walk in, it's quite a sight. Now, maybe it's because I grew up on 80s movies and the John Hughes movie, but they walk in and you immediately think they're the guys dressed in the skeleton costumes chasing the Karate Kid around right. The gym. I mean, they're jocks. They're the quintessential big alpha, jackasses. You look at them and you think, and so when I wrote Accidental Billionaires, which became the movie The Social Network, I think that was the angle we took. They were the bad guys. They were chasing lovable Mark Zuckerberg, who was this, you know, likable nerd around, and they were automatically the bad guys. And I think I got that wrong, to be honest. I think The Social Network was not a fair portrayal of the Winklevi. And that's part of why I wrote Bitcoin Billionaires. It's this amazing second act that you never see coming.
All right, so you laid that out. Like, you thought maybe you were off on that. Maybe they were not who you thought that they were. How did they react to how they were portrayed in the book and in the film?
Right. And let me just add that in high school, I would have been terrified of the Winklevi twins. I would have been hiding in a locker and from the Winklevi twins because that's how they appear. So when they saw The Social Network, they actually came to the premiere. They were my secret source on that book. I used to meet them in Penn Station in stairwells, and they would hand me stacks of legal documents that nobody was supposed to see. They weren't probably supposed to be giving me them because they hate Mark Zuckerberg so much that their goal was to bring him down. So that's how I essentially wrote a lot of The Social Network or Accidental Billionaires. So anyways, when they saw the movie, they didn't love their portrayal, but they also saw parts of it that they agreed with because it was the first time someone was telling a story about Mark Zuckerberg kind of lying and stealing and things like that.
Ben Mezrach joining me in studio. Listen, if you've got a question for Ben about this book or any of his books, any of his movies, the telephone number is toll-free, 1-800-636-8686. All right, so then about a year and a half ago, there's an article about them in the New York Times as the first Bitcoin billionaires. What did you think when you read that?
So I'm sitting there, and I see the New York Times article. It says, the Winklevi twins are the first Bitcoin billionaires. And I had heard of Bitcoin, as we all had. I didn't have any Bitcoin. I didn't ever want to write about it. People have been calling me for years saying, you should write about Bitcoin because it's kind of the stuff I write. But it just makes my eyes glaze over. The idea of like the blockchain and the word crypto, they make you want to throw up, I think. But after seeing the twins were now billionaires, it kind of blew my mind. So I called them up and I went into New York and I sat down with them and I said, What's going on?
Ben, what was that first call like? I mean, were you guys good at that point?
Well, you know, I'd run into them in restaurants a couple of times. And it's funny because they're always like sitting together and they dress the same and they look the same. And I'd run into them a couple of times at parties. And at one point—
In their skeleton suits?
I'll tell you, chasing me around. A few years ago when Bitcoin was at like $5 or $10, the twins had actually said to me, you know, you should buy some Bitcoin, put it away and don't think about it. And I ignored it. And I would probably be a billionaire right now too if I had paid attention to what they were saying. So I sat down with them and they were very open. They just started telling me this crazy story, how they had accumulated 200,000 Bitcoin, 1% of all Bitcoin that will ever be. And they bought it at $7. So it's now, at the time, was worth $5 billion. Right now it's worth about close to $2 billion. And it was amazing because to me it was like they were the bad guys in one story and they were involved in Facebook and suddenly they're in the middle of this second revolution of money, which as I learned, as I dug into Bitcoin, I began to think is something much bigger than just something you gamble on. I think they were at the forefront of something huge and they've come back. And so I was blown away.
All right, so they've come back. Did your impression of them personally, morally or ethically start to change? Did you see them in a different light?
It did. So I started hanging out with them every day. I was like the third Winklevi twins. I was going into New York once a week. And they're much different, you know, once you get to know them than just judging them. It's easy to judge them. They walk into the room. They're privileged. They're gigantic. They're in great shape. And they have tons of money. So you think, okay, these guys are going to be the douches of the story. But once you get to know them, they speak five languages. They're Latin. They're Latin scholars. They can computer code almost as good as Mark Zuckerberg. They understand economics. They're actually really smart guys.
Right.
And, you know, they had built themselves up in all of these different things. And then the Facebook story turned them into caricatures and into jokes. And so I absolutely changed my mind, not just about them, but what their role in the creation of Facebook was.
I was going to say, do you think, knowing what you know right now, do you think they were more involved in the founding and creation of Facebook than originally thought?
Absolutely. So look at Mark Zuckerberg, this nerdy guy, and look at the Winklevi twins. And which do you think is more likely to have created a social network?
Sure.
What the twins did, which was really intriguing, is they actually had the idea of these circles of friends groups. So if you have your family, your friends, then your work people you go to college with. That came from their idea. They also had the idea of using a harvard.edu. You needed a Harvard email to join their site. And when Facebook launched, if you remember, it launched, you had to have a Harvard EDU, then you had to have an Ivy League EDU, then you had a college EDU, then a high school. So basically these circles of difficulty of becoming a part of Facebook, the exclusivity of it is why it immediately took off. And so those two ideas were the twins, as far as they say, and as much as I can tell from looking into it. And I do know now, and it's all in the book, there's these instant messages that Mark sent that were uncovered much later than when we wrote The Social Network, which actually say some very horrible things. Zuckerberg, you know, lied to them. He planned on screwing them over. There's a scene in the book, it all comes out, but he actually hacked into their program and made a fake profile of Cameron Winklevoss through of all this racist, like sexist, crazy stuff. And all of this stuff never came out. But as you look into that, you start to think, well, Mark might have had a plan to screw them over from the very beginning.
Ben Mezrach joining me in studio. All right, so what we're going to do...
By the way, Zuckerberg's not going to like that. And this is the first time I've said it since the book came out. So
I was
we'll going to
say,
happens.
I have not heard that before, and he probably wouldn't like that. But if you don't want people saying things like that about you, don't do things like that, right? Take a break from the backstory and the actual story. I need you to talk about Bitcoin for a minute.
Sure.
Because Bitcoin is one of those things that everybody's heard about, but not a lot of people or everybody knows exactly what it is, or maybe they don't want to sound ignorant, so they don't want to ask. For everybody listening, What is Bitcoin and how does it work?
Sure. So Bitcoin is digital money. What that means is it's computer money. It doesn't exist in the real world. A Bitcoin is something I can send to you without anybody in between us. So it's called peer-to-peer, which means person-to-person. There's no bank. There's no government. It's not backed by anything. So if I have a Bitcoin, I can send it like a text to you. I can send it anywhere in the world instantly. And what's interesting about Bitcoin is it doesn't need a government or anybody like that verifying this transaction. It's verified by all the different people in the Bitcoin world running this software. You don't really have to get into that part because that part gets really like math and it glazes your eyes over. But what Bitcoin is that's interesting is it's something that's instantly transferable that doesn't really show who you are. I mean, it's somewhat private and that you can hold just by having a personal code. A string of numbers is your Bitcoin address, and that's where your Bitcoin is. So people can write it down on a piece of paper, keep it in an electronic wallet on your phone. Some people even imprint it on a ring or get a tattoo, and that code is your Bitcoin. So you could have $10 million on a ring, you know, and there's all these stories about people who like lose, you know, a computer card full of $10 million Bitcoin and are digging through a dump right now looking for their Bitcoin. It's like having all your gold in a safe that you can carry around with you all the time. But what's great about Bitcoin is that, for instance, if you wanted to send a dollar to someone in Africa, how would you do that? There's no real way to do that. But with Bitcoin, I could literally just text him a dollar. And that's what's cool about Bitcoin. What's bad about Bitcoin is that it's started off in this kind of dark world of like drug dealers, because originally people who used Bitcoin were doing a lot of illegal things with it because it was untraceable and there was no government behind it. So there was something called Silk Road on the dark web, which was a drug Amazon where you could buy any drugs you wanted on like buying it on Amazon, and they only took Bitcoin. So that's where the Bitcoin market first started. But now Bitcoin is at a very different place where all these Wall Street banks are looking at it, where people, you can buy things at different places with it, but also use it like gold to store money.
That's a brilliant description.
Yeah, so I don't know if it made it any clearer for you.
No,
but
that makes it much clearer, yeah. I think, for people who do not know. Now, how about this? If you had invested in Bitcoin back in, say, 2009, any idea what that investment would be worth right now?
Yeah, I mean, so Bitcoin was in the dollars, you know, and even before that, when it started, it was in the pennies. There were websites called faucets that just sprayed Bitcoin out. You'd go on and you would just get Bitcoin. And Bitcoin had gone up, went all the way up to $20,000. Today, it's at $7,800 or $7,900. So if you had bought Bitcoin at a dollar, I mean, it was like a $7 million, you know, it's a crazy situation. The first Bitcoin purchase ever was this guy bought two Papa John's pizzas from somebody for 10,000 Bitcoin. And today that's worth almost $800 million.
Holy crap.
So he spent $800 million on two pizzas. And by now you'd think the guy probably killed himself. But it's a crazy amount of money that was made in this industry. And you know, the idea of digital money, if it sounds crazy to you, but what you should know is that all your money is already digital. When you go to a bank and deposit $100, they don't keep $100 in a vault somewhere. It immediately becomes ones and zeros. It becomes cuter money. How much cash do you have? You have maybe $1,000. If you're a gambler, you might have $10,000. But that's not your money. Most of your money, almost all of your money, is already computerized, right? Nobody really has any money.
I do that all the time. I transfer money. I bank online.
Everything's online. And if you think about the future, 50 years from now, we're not going to walk around paying for things with little strips of dead trees in a leather wallet. It's like medieval peasants, right? Buying butter with barter. We're not going to do that. We're all going to use our phones. We're all going to use a code. And so we're going to all be digital at some point anyways. Bitcoin kind of just gets there quicker.
We're talking to Ben Mesrick. He's got a brand new book out. The book is called Bitcoin Billionaires, A True Story of Genius, Betrayal, and Redemption. Again, that book is out right now. You know, Ben, also, you've made the point that Bitcoin could upend the internet. How do you see that happening?
Well, what's interesting about Bitcoin is that there's nobody in the middle of it. What Facebook became was kind of this evil empire where data is controlled and collected, and they have a lot of control of what you do when you're on Facebook. In a similar way, money is controlled either by the government that backs it. So if you use American dollars, then the American government backs it. But if you're in Venezuela, your money is gone to hell, right? Because the Venezuelan economy fell apart. If the American economy falls apart tomorrow, the American dollar falls apart. But Bitcoin doesn't work that way. It's universal. It's peer-to-peer. It has nothing to do with any border or any individual country. So Bitcoin kind of frees you in a way. It's a libertarian. It started with libertarians and anarchists who thought this would upend governments. It would upend banks. Because once the government can't control money anymore, the government loses control over the people. I don't believe that. And I don't think the Winklevier guy, the guys in suits, you know, they're the men of Harvard. They think that Bitcoin should just be another financial instrument, a way of quickly paying for things or of storing money without having to deal with gold bars and things like that.
We were talking to Ben Mesrick. All right, because the clones are so about this. Let's go to the phones really quickly and see what they have to say. We go to Silicon Valley.
Uh-oh.
Will in Silicon Valley. You're on with Ben Mesrick. Will, how are you?
Hey, pretty good. Jim, great show. I'm glad
Thank you
have diversification here. So, and the reason, what I wanted to ask you was, you know, information travels in tight circles. So I was wondering how these East Coast guys got into Bitcoin so early. Are they just lucky?
Right.
You know, because I know I get into deals, but it's based on small networks, information. People are really tight-lipped about stuff. You have to know VCs.
Right.
I'm wondering how these guys...
You're exactly right. And that's actually the first couple
good
chapters
job,
of the
Will.
Book.
Well done.
Yeah, so Bitcoin initially was these little... crypto nerds were all into Bitcoin. It was on these little websites. It appeared out of nowhere in 2008. This guy calling himself Satoshi Nakamoto. No one knows who he is or if he even exists. Created Bitcoin and then vanished. The man's never been heard from before. He supposedly has 1 million Bitcoin and he's gone. So nobody knows what happened to him. The twins, they had settled with Facebook for $65 million. That $65 million, they took it in stock, became $500 million. So they had all this money and they tried to become Silicon Valley investors, but no one would take their money because Silicon Valley, everyone's end game is to sell to Mark Zuckerberg. And if you had the Winklevi on your spreadsheet, Mark wouldn't buy from you. So they went to party in Ibiza, as you do, right? They were on a beach in Ibiza and someone walked up to them and said, "Have you guys ever heard of Bitcoin?" And so it really started by accident. People recognized them from the movie The Social Network and just pitched the idea of Bitcoin to them.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's wild.
Just on a beach.
Yeah.
All right. We're talking to Ben Mesrick. Back to the phones. And this is something that's come up before. I'm glad I know where this guy's going and where he's going to reset. PJ in Mile High. PJ, you're on with Ben Mesrick. How are you?
Hey, I'm great, guys. How are you?
Good.
Excellent.
Good.
So two things that always come up when I'm reading the books, Ben. How do you? I'm wondering how you gain access to and earn trust with the individuals who share this information with you from Chuck in the 37th parallel, who at times was being followed around by some of these crazy federal agents, to the Winklevoss twins sharing with you potentially damaging information to a mogul like Mark Zuckerberg, up to these Bitcoin creators who started doing illegal activities.
Yeah.
How do you gain their trust? And then are you ever apprehensive about sharing the information that they share with you?
Yeah, it's a
good
great question.
Questions. Yeah.
So yeah, I work my way into people's lives. I think I'm like, I don't show up with
or
a tape recorder.
Or they work their way into your life too.
One or the other. I mean, there's, I think Janet Maslin, the New York Times called me a billionaire's best friend because I'm not trying to bring people down in my stories. I try and dive in head first and become a part of the story. I don't have a tape recorder or a notepad. I kind of live with the characters. I work my way in with them. I want to, you know, and in the end, they trust me to at least handle the story as truthfully as possible, but also in a fun way. And so there's a type of character that I think I appeal to. You know, someone like the Winklevi twins or Chuck, and you know, they want to hang out with me and tell me their stories. They're dying to tell their stories. Now, the fearful part, absolutely. There have been a lot of moments in my career where I've been terrified for my life. I've stepped into something that I did not want to step into. I mean, I wrote a book about Russian oligarchs, and there were moments in that story where, you know, I sincerely could have been killed if I had printed the stuff that I had found out. And I just don't print that stuff. I mean, I'm very careful. But in general, you know, like the Winklevi twins, Bitcoin, there's definitely an unsavoriness to some of the characters, and there's drugs and things like that. But these are smart guys. They're geeky guys, most of them. They're people who are involved in something they really believe in, but they're not out to kill anybody. But you have to sort of always know how to get out of the room. I think growing up as a weak small person, I always know how to run out of a room really quickly. So if something really bad happens, I have my exit path already ready. I think that's it's genetically inborn in me, the idea of escape. I can always escape.
Ben Mesrick joining us. I love that line. You got to know how to get out of a room.
All right,
so we're rolling through these calls, and the clones are showing up in a really impressive fashion. Two good calls in a row. Let's try another one. Let's see if we can play a hot hand. We go to, look at this. He's won the smack off twice. Lef in Laguna. You're on with Ben Mesrick. Lef, what's up?
Hey, not much, Jim. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, Ben, two-time smack off champ, Lef Laguna here. Big fan. Quick question. Hypothetically speaking, if you were to invest in Bitcoin today, do you think eventually you'd be able to afford a home in, say, like Corona, California, that doesn't have power lines and dead grass in the backyard? I'm just asking for a friend, so I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah, I don't know if you know this, and I know you know the show, Bam, yeah. But he just took a run at his arch nemesis,
okay.
Brad in Corona. Corona, according to some, I'm not saying it may not be the most desirable place to live.
All right,
it's
yeah.
in the 909 area code.
Yeah.
You don't need to answer that question.
No. Well, listen.
Or you can if you want.
I will say that buying Bitcoin right now, I'm not someone who's going to tell you whether or not to buy Bitcoin. The twins believe it's going to go to $250,000 a coin. Other people believe it's going to go to zero. So you have to look at it and decide, is this gold? Is this the next gold? Or is this something that just disappears in 2 years? And I don't know how to answer that. I thought you were going to ask about Toby in Houston.
I think
that
was going to get there.
Yeah, I thought that was going to go that way.
So Toby, now what about Toby? You have access to a lot of people. How are you going to find Toby?
I will say.
Where would you start?
I spent
and how are you going to approach this?
I spent way more time yesterday looking into Toby in Houston than one should, especially on the first day of your book tour. But I had never seen the word crank used in that fashion before. And that's what intrigued me. I don't know if that is what stunned you, but I didn't know that that's what that meant.
That's tremendous. So what started you down that rabbit hole? A few of the clones.
Oh, God.
So
the clones, I'll tell you, the clones are the best. They tweet with me. I love it. When Bitcoin Billionaires, when it came out, I know that they're going to be running to it. And last time my book came out, I spend all day just retweeting everyone who tweets. It's awesome.
I appreciate you doing that, too.
It's awesome. It's a great group, and it's my audience. And when I wrote this book, I really thought this is a book, Bitcoin Billionaires, that they're going to like, because it got all of those elements to it. And then it has the Winklevi twins, which you really can't even invent if you wanted to.
Love the Winklevi. And listen, I want to manage our expectations, but I can't lie to you, Ben. One of my favorite things is when you come on and the book drops and you can track. Obviously, you can track how the book does after your first day or your first appearance or when the clones start to do what the clones do. This is when, I don't want to say there's a love and hate relationship with the clones, but I love the clones always, but I do have to check them. But there are times when they make me very proud. And when they rush out and they buy your books and there's a measurable, quantifiable difference, that makes me proud.
It runs up Amazon. The clones buy it, and all the New York publishing houses are like, what happened today? What did you do today? And I was like, I went on Rome. I was going Rome.
That's great. That's Ben awesome. Mesrick joining us. Before you go, back in March, Jordan Peele tweeted, feels like The Social Network is due for a sequel. What was your reaction when you saw that tweet?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of talk, actually, from Scott Rudin and Aaron Sorkin, who did The Social Network, about doing a sequel. You know, Zuckerberg, this is another crazy part of the story. The whole thing switched on its head. You know, Zuckerberg was the revolutionary, the good guy, and the twins were the bad guys. Today, Zuckerberg's the bad guy with this evil empire, and the twins are the good guys with Bitcoin. So that flip, it will make a great movie. And there's a place for a sequel to The Social Network and also Bitcoin Billionaires. It's almost like the Marvel Universe. You know, you have the Avengers is The Social Network, and then each character is its own little Wolverine. But yeah, we'll see where it goes. It's exciting. And I have to ask you about your book. You know, when I come on every time, I try and push you in that direction.
I'm as close as I've been. I have changed representation.
Oh.
So we should talk about this.
So we should talk about it.
I still feel like if I couldn't afford you then, I can't afford you now, Ben, but maybe.
Well, my books keep going as high as they go on Amazon after going on your show. It definitely, I think
the price is going up. All right. Ben Mesrick is a jungle legend. You want to get this book right now. It's out. Bitcoin Billionaires. They're like your kids. You can't play favorites, but this one might be the best of the lot. Bitcoin Billionaires, a true story of genius, betrayal, and redemption. It's out right now. Clones, go get it. Ben, I consider you a really good friend. I'm proud to be friends with you. Thank you very much. And great to see you.
You know what? It's an honor to do this first. I love it, man. Thank you so much.
Contractors can rely on Ferguson to provide a winning game plan for any job, any day. Thanks to their pro pickup service, you can choose from thousands of products to order online and pick up in store, which makes doing business with Ferguson the easiest part of your day. I love the NHL. I talk a lot of hockey. However, I do not talk a lot of St. Louis Blues hockey. In fact, if memory serves, in the early part of this season, the only time they got any run on this show is when they fired their head coach. And players got into a fight with each other during practice. And then this happened.
Crap in practice, the battle that was going on there. And you can expect a big game from Robert Bortuzzo here, who's got the puck now.
And he gets it in off the referee. It goes in, but that will not count. You can't score off the referee.
I mean, look at this bounce. I've never seen anything like this one right here.
And then somehow that puck deflects in, and Roberto Luongo's going, what in the world just happened there? Is Robert Bortuzzo's shot goes off the referee, I think, then in the net, and the referee was in the corner. That's one of the weirdest goals you're going to see.
In tonight's game, rule 85-4, if a goal is scored as a result of being deflected directly into the net off an official, the goal shall not be allowed.
Yeah, what rule is it if the goal deflects directly off of the referee's junk into the net? What rule is that? Because that's what that was. That was Robert Bortuzzo scoring a goal off the referee's junk. An all-time great highlight. From the package to the back of the net. From the junk to the back of the net. From the unit to the back of the net. Normally, that would be the greatest moment of a season. Especially for the St. Louis Blues, who we normally do not talk about. But last night changed all that. Because last night, this happened. You heard that correctly. For the first time in nearly half a century, the St. Louis Blues are headed to the Stanley Cup Final. They beat San Jose 5-1. They wrap up that series in six. They went from being down 2-1 in that series to winning three straight. 2-1, 5-0, 5-1. They turned that from a battle into a blowout. The St. Louis Blues are going to the Stanley Cup Final. The thing about that, Alvin, is I thought that when I saw it last night, but I was not going to say it. The St. Louis. No, I'd rather lock in on the fact that they're doing something that has not been done for a half century, and people there are hyped. But nobody there is more hyped than Randy and Jason Sklar, two very, very good friends of this program. What an enormous moment for them. They're huge St. Louis fans. They have been repping the Blues for years. Now they're seeing their guys go to the Stanley Cup Final. I mean, it's such an amazing story. When Pierre McGuire was on the show last week, I asked him about how badly the city of St. Louis wanted this, and for good reason. 49 years is a hell of a long time to wait for anything, and there's been a lot of heartbreak in those 49 years. Really good players who never got that great moment with the blue note on their chest. I mean, really, really good players. Kelly Chase. Does that name ring a bell? The Chaser. Kelly Chase was awesome. How about my man, Chris Pronger? And then came this year, and there was a buzz about the team before the season. There was a buzz, but then they came out and they fell right on their face. Again, a team that fired their head coach earlier in the year. A team that was tied with Ottawa for the fewest points in the league on January 1st. They were on the verge of being gutted and sold off for parts. And then on May 21st, they win the Western Conference. How does that happen? How do you turn around a season like that? You never know, right? But it's always something. A season like that can only turn on one thing, generally. You never know what it is. Maybe it's a big goal, a big come-from-behind victory, one big shift. You never know. But not in this case. In this case, it was a song. And not any song, a classic song from 1982. The Blues are doing something that they haven't done in 49 years. And it all is a result of one thing. One song, and of all songs, this song. You know that song? Laura Branigan's Gloria, if you need it. And you do, because that turned around their entire season. And now that they turned that tune into like some crazy anthem. Good luck getting that out of your head for the rest of the day. But then again, why wouldn't you? Why would you want to? I mean, sure, the Blues have amazing chemistry, and they've got a goalie standing on his head. But what they have more than anything else is Gloria. That's the real reason why their season turned around. You go ahead, you listen to that. I challenge you to hear that song and then tell me your day's not better or your life's not better. It turned their whole season around. And the easy thing to say about this series is that it's San Jose just going San Jose the way San Jose always does. But that's not the case here. What? San Jose? I mean, they're powerless against a track like that. The Blues could have been playing the Islanders or the Oilers in their prime. But once you start bumping that track, the game's over. And if you think I'm making light of it, you don't understand how significant that was, how emotional that was. Kelly Chase was at that game. Kelly Chase saw St. Louis Blues legend Bobby Plager afterwards. The tears were flowing. Some of the toughest guys ever were bawling. Chase said, quote, "I was in the hallway, and I'm looking at people crying in the stands, and I was like, holy bleep. Then I see Bobby Plager, and he started crying. He never cries. And that was just like, that one kind of kicked me in the balls." Such an awesome quote. Then Brett Hull saw Plager crying. And then he saw Kelly Chase crying. And then Hulley started crying. Quote, "But it was after it hit zero." You know, when the clock hit zero. When all of a sudden the flood of emotions hit me. And I looked at Bob Plager, and I'm like, oh my God. I watched Kelly Chase out here, and he was crying. I go, I don't know if I cried that much when I actually won the Stanley Cup. And we still haven't won anything yet. It's so exciting for this franchise, and this city, and the people, and the fans to be going to the Stanley Cup Final. End quote. So you've got all these grown men crying all over the place. Some of the toughest dudes on the planet bawling their eyes out. History being made, tears being shed, Gloria blasting through the city of St. Louis. And I know my boys, the Sklars, have got to be breaking crap in celebration because the Blues are going to the Stanley Cup Final. Sure, I talk hockey. All kinds of hockey, regular season hockey, postseason hockey.
I love when you talk hockey.
But I never talk St. Louis Blues hockey.
St. Louis.
Never. Not unless a guy's getting fired early in the season when they're supposed to be one of the odds-on favorites, or a guy is scoring a goal off the referee's package. But I am now. St. Louis, reaction.
St. Louis.
Listen, you've heard all the excuses for not buckling up. I'm not going very far. I'm in a rush. It's too uncomfortable. Sometimes I just forget. Look, don't kid yourself. There is no such thing as a good excuse for not putting on your seatbelt. If you've used any of these excuses or any other, you are putting yourself at risk of injury or death. In 2017, more than 10,000 people were unbuckled when they were killed in crashes. That's 51% of people killed in motor vehicle crashes that were not wearing seatbelts. No matter what kind of a car you drive, wearing your seatbelt is the best defense in a crash. Even when you sit in the back seat, you still need to buckle up. That goes for riding in taxis, using ride-sharing services too. Cops are on the lookout and they're writing tickets. So why would you take that risk? In 2017 alone, seatbelts saved nearly 15,000 lives. So do the smart thing. Buckle up every trip, day or night. Click it or ticket. Paid for by NHTSA. Calais Campbell is my guest. Calais, good to have you back. How are you?
Hey, man, it's always good talking to you. Doing well.
Calais, my man, I can't believe we're talking again already. Where did that offseason go? Did it feel like it went by pretty quickly? And how did it feel to get back to OTAs and be amongst the guys?
Yeah, offseason is going on faster. The older you get, it seems like, you know, after that, I just trained nonstop the whole time pretty much. So it Well, good to be back around the guys, though. Get on the field and have some fun out there, man.
Calais Campbell joining us. Fact is, though, you are entering your 12th NFL season. And, Calais, when you consider the average length of an NFL career is a little over three seasons, and you're going into your 12th, how much pride is there for you in that number?
Yeah, I take a lot of pride in it, you know. It's a blessing. You know, worked hard, you know, throughout my life, man. And, but, you know, it's crazy because I feel like I still got it, you know. Still playing at a high level, and I'm enjoying it. I love it. So just going to ride it till the wheels fall off.
Hey, listen, I was going to go there next. It's not like you're coasting either. You're coming off back-to-back Pro Bowl seasons. And knowing that, how much better are you as a player right now than when you first entered the league?
So much better. I wish I had the mind I have now when I was a rookie, or even, you know, the third and fourth year. You know, I mean, physically, I definitely know I'm not what I used to be. But I'm still pretty good. But my mind, you know, and just what I can do, it's crazy, man, how much, you know, your mind plays a big role in this game.
Calais Campbell joining us. I mean, obviously you're going to work hard on the physical side of your game, but to that point about your mind, I mean, how much of what you do and how much of the success you're having right now is about experience and having seen just about everything there is to see in the game and having that experience?
Yeah, I mean, well, my physical ability definitely, I joke around, but I work really hard to stay in really good shape. But the mental side of it is, that is the icing on the cake. That's that next level. And being able to study tape and, you know what I'm looking at and be able to see things before they happen in the game setting, you know, that really plays big dividends in my production.
We're talking to you, Jacksonville's Calais Campbell. See, the thing is, I mean, when you've proven yourself, and I could argue that when you've had the success that you've had, you really don't need OTAs, but you seem to get more and more hyped every single year. How do you explain that? How do you stay that excited to do the type of work that a lot of guys do not want to do, that frankly maybe you don't have to do?
Yeah, well, for me, OTAs are, I mean, it's not the same. Like, at the beginning of your career, it's about, like, really perfecting your technique and really learning what you need to do to be great in the NFL, you know. But after so many years when you kind of really have that down, and I mean, it's still, I'm sharpening my tools, I'm getting back into that rhythm and everything, but at the end of the day, it really is about, like, understanding the playbook, understanding, you know, who my opponents are, understanding, and even then, like, you know, because I've been in the system now going on my third year, and I've played against it quite a bit, you know, when Seattle was the exact same system we did, so I understand it at a high level. But just trying to find the different understandings of it, where I can take my advantages and, like, kind of, you know, cheat a little bit based off of, like, where my help is and understanding just the concept of the defense at the highest level. You know, that's what this time I'm here for. For me, is to understand the defense as best I can and really be able to understand what my opponent's trying to do to me in an overall sense. You know, so I definitely started kind of looking ahead at this point in time, but also still trying to help some other guys on my team come along and see it, you know, that way too. You know, there's a lot of conversations about the overall big picture happening right now, you know, and, you know, you can't put the cart before the horse, you have to take it one day at a time. But I definitely get with some of the, you know, third and fourth year guys to try to make sure they understand, like, how people try to attack our defense, you know, what we need to see.
That's a great response. Calais Campbell joining us. So when you look at that big picture that you speak of, you know, as an example, you're coming off another really, really good individual season, but obviously the team did not have the results that you had been hoping for. There were really high expectations coming into the 2017 season. So as you look back, Calais, on last season, what did happen?
You know, it has to go down to youth. You know, I mean, we faced some adverse situations, you know, in 2017, we were very, very healthy. You know, had no issues. Last year, we had some injuries come, you know, early and often, you know. And then, you know, when losses started piling up and we started kind of things didn't go our way, you know, it really showed, you know. We started really, you know, being young and making young mistakes. And, I mean, it's a good learning experience. You know, hopefully, you know, I mean, I'm pretty sure most of the guys learned a lot in that scenario, learned what not to do in those scenarios, you know, when you start, you know, pressing too hard when you're losing the game. But the biggest thing, I think, is just understanding that you can't look too far forward. You know, I think that's one thing that everybody is guilty of, you know, and, you know, we kind of let the outside world kind of, you know, put us where we could end up and not really where we were at the moment. And, you know, I mean, I think it's a lot easier now after a couple of 5-11 season where you just stay, you know, in the moment, you know, where you're at right now, what you need to do today to be better, you know, instead of worrying about what could happen if everything goes according to plan.
Well, I appreciate that response. Calais Campbell joining us. Calais, Telvin Smith announced recently that he's going to step away from the game for the 2019 season. I know you've been in touch with him. What was your reaction when you heard that news?
Yeah, you know, I mean, he's kind of been our emotional leader, you know, as a team. You know, I mean, he has the gift to inspire, you know. And so he's a guy who, when he's on the field and helping us, you know, we're a lot better with. So, you know, I know he has a lot of stuff going on in his life that he needs to get, you know, together. And, you know, just where he's at, you know, I mean, you sacrifice so much to play this game. Everybody who plays this game long enough knows, like, it's hard. You have to give so much. And so I understand, you know, need to break it, need to kind of, you know, get your priorities in order. But I'm hopeful. I'm very hopeful that, you know, he can get that done and join us this year, because I feel like we have a real special thing going. But at the same time, I understand, you know, for him, you know, this is real, you know, and that, you know, he might not be out there with us this year, you know, and that's a real possibility. But at the end of the day, you know, you go with what you have, you know, and you make the best of it. But we're a lot better team with him on the field. So, you know, try to get him back right, get him where he needs to be so he can go out here and be the Tyler Smith that he's, you know, accustomed to being.
Having another really nice conversation with Calais Campbell. I've got a few more moments with him. Also, the team added Nick Foles in free agency. So what did you think when you saw that news?
I loved it. You know, I mean, you can tell that he really, a light bulb came on for him throughout his career. And, you know, he's really found, you know, some success in the NFL. I mean, Super Bowl MVP. How many people can say that? You know, not many. And for him to be able to, you know, come and join our team, you know, and just really – with our system that we have in place with, you know, DeFilippo, and really the talent we have on defense, you know, I think we could do some great things together. And he's a natural leader. And just in these first couple of weeks with him, you know, that's huge. Having that leadership, that 30-year-old, seen it all before, confident, it's contagious, you know, and it makes everybody else around him more confident. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what we can do together.
Calais, you're all in on the field, and it's pretty clear you're all in off the field. I mentioned in the introduction, back in February, he received the Bart Starr Award for Outstanding Character and Leadership on the field and in the community. It's a really significant honor. What's that award mean to you?
It's huge. You know, I mean, it's you know, when I first won it, I was kind of, you know, really excited. But the more I went through the process of learning, you know, about, like, what it represents as a whole and, like, where it started, and I was even more, you know, honored. It's probably the best award I've ever received. And, you know, it's just, I mean, when you can be, you know, picked by your peers, people that you play the game with, you want their respect, that they see your, you know, your efforts and what you're trying to do with this game and in the community, it's a true honor. You know, there's no better feeling than knowing that, you know, that, you know, my efforts are not going unseen, and the things I'm trying to do in this world, you know, it's nice to know that I have the support of my peers. You know, it's a true blessing.
Listen, before you go, you and I have talked about your work with the CRC Foundation in the past. It's named after your late father, Charles Richard Campbell. You don't do this kind of work for recognition, but what's it like when people honor you for the work that you've done in your father's memory?
You know, really, when you know, it's really the honor that's going to him, you know, and what he did with his kids and making sure that we understood what it meant to give back and our duties, especially with the more you succeed, the more you get opportunities, you have to really go back and reach back and pull people along. And being able to do that, being able to try to just affect the world in a positive manner, you know, is something that, you know, was instilled in me and taught to me at a young age. And so, you know, me and all my family and people who help with the foundation, just try to represent it, you know, do things the right way, you know, the way that would make him proud. So, you know, it's winning like the Bart Starr Award, or, you know, really just, you know, being able to put a smile on a kid's face and teach him something that, you know, that he needed to learn. You know, I mean, I know my dad would be smiling down right now, you know, very proud. So that's a real good feeling.
You bet. Four-time Pro Bowler, and again, the recipient of the 2019 Bart Starr Award for Outstanding Character and Leadership on the Field and in the Community, Jacksonville Jaguar defensive lineman Calais Campbell. Calais, appreciate the relationship. Always good to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Hey, always a pleasure, man. Take it easy. Thanks for having me.
Good night now!